What's going on, you degenerates? How is everybody today? Are you having a good day? That's nice. I don't care. Welcome to the QTR podcast. It's lovely to be here. This podcast is brought to you by my patrons. Patrons are people that sign on to Patreon and donate a small recurring monthly sum to help support the podcast. First and foremost, want to shout out my friends over at Quantamize.com, Quantamize, Quantamize is an AI-powered platform. We'll give you access to over 10,000 stocks, options, and crypto. Was recently rated the number one alternative to the Bloomberg terminal, and their service is entirely free. You can check out the link in my podcast description. That's Quantamize.com. Also, what's up to my friends? Rumorhound.ai. Do you have trouble sifting through all the bullshit and nonsense when it comes to rumors about mergers and acquisitions? I know I sure do. It feels like I'm on a 10-year streak of only going after rumors that don't pan out. I may be holding some type of Guinness Book World Record without even knowing it. If you feel like that, you may want to check out my friends over at rumorhound.ai. They have a fantastic piece of AI-powered software that tries to sift through the rumors about mergers and acquisitions to let you know, based on the sources they come from and all kinds of computerized shit that I'll never understand if I live to be 105, which ones have credibility and which ones do not have credibility. Their link also in the profile of my podcast. You can check them out, rumorhound.ai. They are good friends and good supporters of the podcast, so please shoot them a play. Also, my friends over at Hella Bacon. Hella Bacon's a bunch of guys from Texas that shoot machine guns out of helicopters. If you have any questions, write your congressman. I don't know anything else. Their link is also in my podcast description. Finally, I want to shout out some of my top patrons, the people that I always like to give love to, people like Corvus Gold, Nick Parks, Nathan Machaud, Chris Bede, Ken R., Chris Boas, my brother Russ Valenti, my friend Piggly Wiggly, my friend Cool Death, Nathan Weiss, Mike, and Matt Merrill. I appreciate you guys so much. Mitchell Penrod, I see you. William Davis is in the house. And some of my newest patrons, guys like Andy M., Matt Kiefer, Valentine Baker, Pasha. Pasha, did I say that right? What's going on? We'll just say Valentine. Rob Lipich just checked in again. I appreciate him. Tom Luongo, Andre Gavrilov, Christian Kohlheim, Mark Balser, Malte Daniels, Aurelian Briere, Brad Ridge, Bill McMahon. What's going on? Pat Osgood. Man, it's been a while since I've done some shout-outs. And going back to a little place I like to call the motherfucking vault, how about my friend Louis Chang? What's up, Louis? You tried to be a patron once, and your card got declined. I hope I'm not blowing up your spot. But you did donate $5 once, and for that, Lewis, I thank you very much. I really hope I didn't just blow up your spot, dude. But anyways, that's what happened according to the screen I have here in front of me. Rahul Desai, what's going on? Andrew Lookers, what's going on? Gene W. Cruz is in the house. My friend Brian Weckman is still here. Michael Hahn is still hanging around. BG, Jack Sinef. I always see that, and I always think it says Jack Meehoff. You know that fake name that people use? Matt is in the house. Fraser McKenzie's still here. Doug Christensen, Jack Burton, Chris Ward, and finally, last but not least, Trevor Courtney is in the house. All right, two things before we get started today. Number one, this podcast is not investment advice, and if you think it is, you're a fool, and you deserve to lose all your money. I hold no registrations and no licenses. I'm not a professional, ladies and gentlemen. Literally, my job 8 years ago was taking beer out of a big keg and putting it into glasses and then handing it to people while taking several taste tests myself along the way. And we can talk about that at length some other time. I think the statute of limitations has passed on that, hopefully. And finally, I do encourage a two-drink minimum for this podcast. People email me all the time. Chris, can I do three? Chris, can I smoke a joint instead? Chris. Yeah, do whatever you want. Just stop emailing me. And if you have any questions, sign up for my Patreon and somebody will get back to you in somewhere between 6 months and the next 10 years. I have on the line with me one of my favorite guests and one of my podcast listeners' favorite guests who's coming back for, it feels like, the third time in 3 days, Mr. Dave Collum. Dave Collum is an economic commentator, a life commentator in general on this show. He's a chemist and a professor of chemistry and chemical biology at Cornell University. And what's up, Dave?
Not much. Just hanging out here trying to earn a day's wage.
How's that working out?
I think I'm going to get paid. I'm actually trying to get payment out of a company that that I don't understand how to put in an invoice to, so I don't know how to get paid, but that's a separate issue.
Dave, today I wanted to just open up the bidding by asking you about Tesla, because it's not something that we've ever really discussed at length, number one. And number two, because it's been such a shit show over the last 2 weeks. And I think in the Venn diagram of my podcast listeners, the intersection is somewhere between drunks, degenerates, and Tesla shorts. And so I wanted to see if I could cover all three of those immediately.
Okay. What do you want to know?
Well, I just wanted to know what your thoughts were on the situation. I realized that we had never really talked about it on previous podcasts. And here the stock's off $100 over the last 3-4 weeks. And I wanted to kind of get your commentary on that. I mean, is it a name that you've ever looked at or no?
Well, you know, as I've said before, I don't short. If I did, I would short Tesla. I really don't know squat about Tesla besides what I read from people, you know, on sort of the digital world who talk about Tesla. It seems as though too many of their cars are lighting on fire and locking people out and causing crashes and stuff like that. Again, my suspicion is that he's a beta test, and that as soon as electric cars really become the thing to own, you're going to want to buy a Volvo or something like that. So my suspicion is Tesla is going to end up on the trash heap of history, but this is totally uneducated.
Well, from your that's okay, because we do a disclaimer on this podcast, and it's called Nobody Understands Anything, So Don't Listen to Us. And that pretty much is right. A blanket statement that covers us. So with that being said, do you think there's any brand equity in the company, given the fact that, you know, it's got $12 billion in debt? Does somebody make a bid for this company if it goes down to 50 or 70?
You know, I don't. The bid would have to come from their IP, right? The bid would have to come from the patents that they hold.
Well, they don't have any IP.
Well, they got a problem because their factories are made out of tents, and so it's not like they own a huge amount of real estate, or I don't think. Maybe they do, but I don't think so. So I think the Tesla, if there's no IP, right, that shows you how little I know, that I don't know that. But if there's no IP, then I don't think Tesla's worth anything. I did happen to catch on the fly this morning, I think it was, that Morgan Stanley's bear case on Tesla is 10. It caused it to plunge under 200. I got to figure if Morgan Stanley's right, the downside is substantially below 200. Could be the headline, like when they asked, you know, Bloomberg asked, is Amazon a $12 stock, right? I kind of wish I'd taken that as a cue to buy them. But my suspicion, if I just as an amateur, I would guess that Tesla probably gets sold off on the courthouse step somewhere.
Yeah, the interesting thing is Amazon eventually got to a point where they were generating cash, right? Where they were eventually started to, you know, pull a consistent profit, even though it was minuscule. I think they strung together a couple of quarters, and we see a big difference here in Tesla coming back and, you know, saying,
Amazon's also creating the Death Star, right? I mean, Tesla's not doing that. So Amazon's, I think, is putting all their money into building a gigantic moat, arguably one of the biggest moats ever around their company. Bezos, as I'm told, again, this is all way outside my wheelhouse, but Bezos seems to be religiously opposed to paying taxes on profits, and so you're not going to see profits out of it. And maybe that's the party line of a scam artist, right? You know, says we're not profitable because I don't want to pay taxes. Maybe that's the pitch. It's unbelievable what Amazon is doing in terms of controlling the world. And my model on Amazon is that they're going to, after they destroy everybody, then they're going to open up bricks and mortars and sell everything just like they used to.
Well, they've already started to do that, haven't they?
Yeah, I know. And so the question is it destroy bricks and mortar and then build it back up, or is it to have a little bit, but mostly, I just don't know. But I look at Tesla, and they're making their cars in tents in the desert, and their CEO looks like kind of one of these dreamer types, of which for every one like Jobs or Thomas Edison or whatever, there's probably 1,000 who end up destitute.
Yeah, you were actually around during the Jobs era, as I saw most of it too, the first one and the second one. I mean, is anything off the top of your head kind of differentiate the two?
If any of your listeners haven't read Jobs' biography, you're missing a great opportunity, because it's not only about Jobs himself, but it's about the history of modern computer era. So it's a fascinating biography, and it's well written, and you find out what a complete whack job Jobs was. Again, for every person with Jobs-like personality, for every one of him, there's countless Steve Jobs types who fail because that personality that he had was a failing personality. I mean, he was a unstable personality at some level.
Right.
But sometimes the right place, right time, knew how to manage. I don't know what it was, but I mean, he used to cry in meetings and, you know, just didn't shower, didn't, right? What about that is successful? I don't know. But he had a vision. His vision was real. So then does Musk have a vision? But I think Musk is too, Jobs was obsessed about achieving what he knew, what he really felt should be done. And Musk seems to be much more P.T. Barnum.
And Jobs was really a seller, too. I don't know. He came off, to me at least, and I have a pretty fair understanding of the history of the company. I mean, he was always a seller. He was always way more in tune with profitability than I feel like Musk is. I feel like Musk, you know, look, they get compared because they're both quote-unquote visionaries, right? Which means that you conceptualize something in your head and you put it out there and say, hey, here's what I'm going to do, without really taking into account whether or not it's feasible, or certainly whether or not you could turn a profit in Musk's case. But I always remember from what I've read about Jobs and what I've seen about him that even from the beginning when Wozniak put together the first Apple prototype in the box that they brought to the, I think it was the Homebrew Computer Club, you know, his right. motivation was always, hey, we could turn around and fucking sell these things. You know, it costs us $30 to make them and we can sell them for $99, you know? So it's like, and I think maybe what's happened, Dave, is since then, since the 70s, you know, a lot of these basic kind of economic, what we thought were laws, right? Like try to turn a profit if you're going to sell something, have just kind of just gone the way of the wind, thanks to, you know, the Krugmans and the Ocasio-Cortezes. And it's just like, all right, you know, you think about profits last, I guess, now when it comes to business.
Well, Federal Reserve, too. The thing about Jobs is so mysterious to me is that, what's not mysterious, he had an obsession over perfection. And so he paid attention to every single detail, including, you know, the color of the box and the shape of the computer and what was on the inside, not the outside. And in that sense, he was an unbelievable purist. Oftentimes that's a failure, though, right? Oftentimes that leads to catastrophe. But somehow his vision led to phenomenal stuff. And he was able to, you know, he never asked the public what they wanted. He told them. And so so there's something just special about him, something that was just so profoundly lucky. And he may have been there at the right time. And he, you know, but I'm just not sure Musk fits that same description.
I think the right time is actually a lot of it, right? Because I think what happened was, and I probably get some of this wrong, but I think what happened was they turned around, they started selling a shitload of the original Apples. I forget what the original one was called before the Apple II. I think maybe it was just called the Apple One. I don't know. But anyways,
I don't know.
They started selling a lot of the original ones, and then they got a bunch of, you know, people that wanted to whisk them up and take them public, which they did. And then his really, to the best of my understanding, his perfectionist kind of gene kicked in when they went to switch from Apple to Macintosh. And that was like the first, I think, or the Lisa, maybe even before that, was the first one that he kind of obsessed over all the aesthetics. But by then he had already had a cushion of, you know, all of this funding and a profitable business to begin with, where Musk, I think, put the vision first and never really circled that first square of like, how are we going to fund the operations?
Well, the other thing about the lucky part, someone did an analysis of all these tech whiz kids, and I guess I'm gonna try to replicate maybe the list, although I could be wrong. But if you look at Scott McNeely, Bill Gates, Steve Jobs, Larry Ellison, and you could go on and on and on, they all happen to be about the same age within about 2 years. And
right.
So maybe I got that out of Jobs' biography, maybe some other book. I read a bunch of those, like by that Clark, that entrepreneur Clark, and somehow it was like the time was right. And whoever, it's like playing whack-a-mole or musical chairs or something. The time was right. And whoever was positioned the instant the music started or stopped, if you want to think of it that way, you know, was at least had a chance to win Powerball, right? And that if you were there a little too early, you're there a little too late, you missed. And so I think the idea was just your mallet was coming down when the mole's head was coming up, and if you were lucky, you hit the mole's head. So I think there was huge luck in that sense.
And I think that's what happened with the original like Windows prototype, right? Because I think Jobs had introduced Gates to – he gave Gates a look at the Macintosh operating system, which, of course, Jobs stole most of the concepts from Xerox. And then he gave Gates a look at it. And Gates turned around and turned that into Windows, which he layered on top of DOS – which is still a work in progress here 40 years later. But,
big time.
And then he just rushed to market with the stuff first, like you're saying. And what
well,
happened?
Well, so, yeah, I mean, it was already... So he gave them a look by selling them. I mean, they were out there. The amazing thing, there's a bunch of stories out there that are kind of interesting and tied to Cornell, actually, where... there was a kid who I actually knew as an undergrad, and he went off to work at Microsoft, and Gates was not taking the internet very seriously, and this kid named Steve Sanofsky supposedly came back to Reunion. I don't know if I talked to him then or not, but he came back to Reunion, and Cornell had wired up. Cornell had the campus wired up, and it was this supposedly legendary email that he sent to Bill. He said, "Bill, all of Cornell's wired." And Gates said, "Holy shit!" And that's when he sort of did turn the entire super tanker around. And Sanofsky ended up being a president of I can't remember his formal title, but I think he was right underneath Ballmer after Gates left. So I think his title was president of Windows, blah blah blah, whatever. And I had some hysterical moments chatting with him where I couldn't get my goddamn Outlook to work. And so here I am getting former president of Microsoft helping me troubleshoot my Twitter. And at one point I bitched at him. You know, he's not there anymore, so I can bitch at him. He didn't give a shit. But I bitched at him, and I said, "Steve, I said, when, you know, the Microsoft just changed the menu again. I can't find shit." I said, that's like moving Helen Keller's furniture around the house, right? That's just not fair." And he said, his response was, "I thought we locked it down in 2007. I'm as clueless as you are."
And what year was this that you were talking to him?
About a month ago. and so the gist is that he was there late, but it kind of at the right time. But Microsoft is things are still changing there. They're a commodity now, so I don't think they're going to pioneer anything. Bing is not competed with Google, but some point Microsoft ought to be a dividend play. Right now, it's not, but. At some point, it ought to be.
Well, it's that getting that first mover advantage is what put them there, right?
Yeah, and so a friend of mine at Goldman took him public, and my old roommate actually, and I asked him. I said, "Was Microsoft always a guarantee? I mean, as you look back," he said, "No, they faced truly existential risk on a number of occasions, and so." You know, and when they first started out, you know, they had to buy the DOS program after they promised to provide the system to IBM. They had to go find one.
And so yeah, they sold the license to IBM, and they didn't have it, right?
Well, they leased it to IBM, which was truly amazing. Boy, talk about a short-sighted move by IBM. And then there were a number of times along the way. One of the big moments, I'm going to flip back to Apple. Apple was on the, you know, on its deathbed at one point. And then I don't know if you remember this or you've seen videos of it, but there was this thing where Jobs got Gates to commit a couple hundred million dollars of software development for Apple. And it was, you know, a couple hundred million. I don't know what that even means, but it was kind of a either a vote of confidence or saying we have Apple's back. And that might have been pretty near the low. I almost bought Apple when they put the Intel chip in. The timing would have been unbelievable, but I don't think that was why it was the correct move. I think I was wrong about that. But I didn't buy them. That's another column masterful move. But
they took like a 7% stake in the company, didn't they?
I guess so. I don't quite know how that worked. I'm picturing the video, and they were still young kids almost. They're pretty young, you know. Gates was skinny little kid. Jobs was, and they're sitting on stools on the stage.
Yeah,
it was clear that
and
Gates
people were booing and shit. I remember because you had all the people that were religious Apple fanatics. It was at a keynote speech. It may have been at the Macworld Expo. I can't remember.
I don't know. I don't know, but I just remember seeing it. I mean, maybe it was like Revenge of the Nerds or something. There was a documentary on it. So in any event, so Jobs was special. I don't think Musk is special. I he might be kind of special, but here's a fact. I went looking up an acquaintance of mine, a guy named Bob Langer, who's a professor at MIT, to see what they said about him on Wikipedia. And I looked him up, and it turns out he's the second largest patent holder. He is ahead of Thomas Edison and only behind Edwin Land. This is a guy, this is a current professor at MIT, a current professor. The guy's got some like 750 licensing agreements worldwide as a professor of engineering at MIT. There's a biggie.
Yeah, he's probably doing quite well.
Yeah, he's doing quite well. Former Cornell undergrad. And that's why I was interacting with him, because I set up a symposium with a couple others we organized and brought in Cornell alums to speak. And I couldn't get Sinofsky to come, his loss. Yeah, I couldn't tie him down, but we had some smart guys in, and Langer came, and it was just awesome to watch this. There's a guy, there is a masterful genius type, is Bob Langer.
I had said on one of my podcasts prior that, you know, I think one of the problems is when you memorialize a guy like Jobs, right, after he dies, and, right. You know, really his legacy is cemented at that point. I mean, he was a living legend when he came back and turned the company around, and certainly in the business world, and, you know, played to a lot of different ethoses, right? But I think when you memorialize somebody like him, the question automatically kind of turns to who's going to be the next one, right? Like who's going to be the next Steve Jobs,
right?
And, well, I think that that's I think that that kind of turning directing your attention to that question is what gave us Musk and what gave us Elizabeth Holmes, right?
Because I haven't read Bad Blood yet. I just came back from Pfizer last week, and one of my friends there said you got to read Bad Blood. It's so amazing. What a psychopath. So she's just a fraud, right? She's just a total hoseback. But so she's not a visionary at all. She's a sociopath with you know, she's Ponzi. She's whatever you want to call her.
Yeah, but my point is she doesn't get surrounded by enablers and people that hold her up and hoist her up as the next big thing. And
they found out she was Bernie Madoff's niece or something.
Right. But my point is that doesn't happen unless people are like hungry to memorialize Jobs' legacy. If they're looking to find the next Steve Jobs, you know, people are so hungry for that. You know, they're so hungry.
Also, the evidence of hot money, right? So right now, there's, you know, the yield-seeking hot money, which is out there in spades. And you have an awful lot of people betting big money, and they've got one eye on the door, right? So you can't find a big player out there who doesn't know that the cycle could end very abruptly. So the most dangerous thing we face right now is just that there's huge amount of money being thrown into the system, and every one of those people is skittish. And so when it turns, I think it's going to turn phenomenally quickly. And so Tesla is just without the ridiculous levels of liquidity. I'll call it liquidity, but pump and dump, whatever you want to call it. Without that, I don't think Tesla.
You just say
exists.
Dumb money.
Well, it's dumb money from smart guys, right? It's big money, but I don't think Tesla exists in its current form without the steroid money that's been pumped into the system for the last 10 years. Right? You look back, you know what Tesla's chart looks like. All of a sudden, it goes from nothing to the stratosphere in a period of about 6 months. It just took off. And someone said, oh, that's the S3 or whatever. I don't care what it is. I mean, they still haven't proven to most people that they can make cars.
And the bonds, the 2025 bonds are trading 82, Dave.
Yeah, and I just read that they think they're going to go down to pennies on the dollar. So, you know, who knows? That could be a bear writing the article. Who knows?
Well, I'm sure, but still, that's a divergence between the bond market and the equity market. I mean, you can't have the equity priced at 200, slapping the valuation on the company that it does, and have the debt market's basically telling you, like, there's a legitimate risk of default. I mean,
So who goes down the toilet first, Deutsche Bank or Tesla?
That's a great question.
I guess you'd have to say Tesla because Deutsche Bank has sovereign backing, right?
Yeah.
But they've already eviscerated their investors, right? I happen to look, Deutsche Bank's 95% off its all-time high. 95%, right? There's nothing left. The only thing left are the guys who say sell at zero.
Mm-hmm. Just to go back to what you were talking about before, about kind of people rushing to get stuff done because they know that the market's about to turn. I was just reading an article probably a week or two ago about, I think it was on Bloomberg or Zero Hedge, I can't remember, but about people rushing to get these deals done because they know time is running out, right? I mean, you saw the Lyft IPO fell. The Uber IPO was a disappointment. And now you have WeWork and you have Slack and, you know, Beyond Meat just came out. You have all these companies that are kind of rushing now.
Yeah, Beyond Meat. Doesn't that sound disgusting? Beyond Meat, right? That's like, yeah, Horseshit Incorporated. What does that? Beyond Meat. I think the Uber IPO also had some fraud associated with it. And I got into a big debate with a couple of tweeters who think I'm a stupid shit, which means maybe it's my wife or something tweeting behind some pseudonym. But the article said that Morgan Stanley naked shorted in an unconventional way the Uber IPO. Now there was a huge debate that broke out over that article that basically said that's not illegal. And I said, if it's naked shorting, it is illegal. Naked shorting is by definition illegal. And then they said, no, this is the green shoe thing. No, this is not the green shoe thing.
This is above and beyond the green shoe.
Well, the green shoe thing's the opposite, right? Doesn't the green shoe thing allow them to buy if it dips? Well, naked shorting is where they're selling into the dip. And they're selling without borrowing the share, so they're increasing the float. And if they're not increasing the float, they're not naked shorting it. So that's this paradoxical. It's either illegal. And people think naked shorting means unhedged. No. Naked shorting is when you sell shares that don't exist.
Right.
And so, you know, Patrick Byrne of Overstock.com, he's kind of wacky in his own way. But he did a great job of educating the public about how naked shorting destroys companies. So apparently Morgan Stanley naked shorted them coming right out the gate, with the idea that they would then cover their shorts. They said they would cover their shorts to protect the shares. I'm not sure, right? That doesn't sound
There's only one reason that you would do that, and that's if you know that there's going to be pressure on the price as soon as the company goes public. And obviously, you know, they had seen the Lyft IPO probably 3 weeks earlier or 4 weeks earlier. They already had the ball moving on the Uber IPO. They can't just turn around and say, oh, can we unfile all these forms? They got everybody committed, the documents signed. You know, everything's done. The founder's probably getting ready to sell a nice whack of equity into the fucking IPO. I mean, you're not going to stop that train once it starts. So what do they think? Probably how are we going to hedge ourselves knowing that this thing's going to be a disaster? And they say, all right, well, we're here. We'll create a synthetic offer and turn around and pitch it to the
like
dumb fucks that are reading the headline saying, oh, this is a great way for us to support the price. It's like, hey,
I look at a company like Uber, though, and I see a very different company than Tesla. So the I think the problems with Uber, if I'm getting this right, I have to reiterate this. I don't know squat about what I'm talking about here. This is just what I'm trying to pick up from the media. But to me, Uber looks like it could be at some point a great buy at the right price. The problem they have right now that I see is that they're not profitable. They've got a workforce that basically is now getting rowdy, and they've actually had a walkout, you know, where they said no one drive, and to try to show that even though there is a highly disconnected group of people driving Ubers, that they could collectively organize a problem. And my son called and was laughing about it. I said, well, Thomas, you know, if they all walk off, they are more organized than you think.
Right.
And if the people who are driving Uber can't make any money, right, if they're really making nothing, which is what I've heard, then basically you've got desperate slave laborers, and that can't last for very long, I don't think. Now, the reason Uber looks like a buy to me at some point at the right price, because it seems to me that Uber might be the brand name that you want to buy if electric self-driving cars start to kick into gear. Fred Hickey says it's going to be a lot longer than we think before self-driving cars are on the road. But to me, Uber's potentially a network in place with brand name recognition in which you rent access to cars, right? Self-driving. So I think at some point we don't own cars. We just subscribe. And you could subscribe to, you know, luxury cars. You could subscribe to anything you want. And you just call it like you call your horse or something. And if we get to that mode, then the Uber network might be precious and the brand might be precious. And what Uber then has to do is just buy a fleet of cars. Someone said, well, that'll cost a fortune. I said, do the math. I don't know, 2 million cars times how much per car? That's just an IPO, right? It's not that much money. And so Uber could be positioned at some point. I'm just guessing, right?
Well,
Uber could be insolvent before that day arrives.
That's true, but I think you make really good sense. And I actually had a conversation just like this with my friend Kubiko probably about 2 weeks ago when after Lyft had IPO'd and started to kind of, or maybe it was after the Uber IPO. And I said something very similar, which is there's a price to buy this. It's still a speculative buy. But here's why I believe of there, I've trashed both of those IPOs publicly, and I stand by that because the IPOs were fucking cash grabs, as they always are, at ridiculous valuations. But here's what tickles my fancy when I think about the two of those companies, right? The first is the first mover advantage, like we just talked about with Microsoft, right? There are Uber and Lyft apps on phones now. Everybody knows the brand name. You know, I just watched the LMA boot up video. I don't know if you know that song, but you know, she shows up in a Lyft car with a big Lyft logo right in the middle of the fucking music video. So the brand recognition is there, exactly what you're arguing. They have the advantage of not having to put all these employees on the payroll, which is another thing. They can offer them kind of these stupid little benefits that they offer them, like, hey, you know, we'll give you $50 off health insurance if you buy it through one of our partners every month or whatever. But these aren't regular salaried employees on the payroll. These are contract employees, so they have a lot of advantage there. That's number two. Number three, your point about these companies creating a network, and eventually, I think 15 years, 20 years, 25 years down the road, when what we're doing is hitting a button on the phone and a, you know, fully autonomous electric car is coming and picking us up, because there's no doubt about it, that's the way that we're going. If they can survive that long and they can generate a profit, you know, they could be, you know, Uber could be to autonomous driving what Microsoft is to computers, what Apple is to computers. So what I said to my friend Kubiko is, I think if they go low enough, like I could see Google buying Lyft and integrating it with Waymo. That makes sense to me. The other interesting thing that I like about Uber and Lyft, even though I hate companies that are consistently unprofitable, so I have really shit on both of these companies, but if there's one thing that I like about them, it's that their calculations, Dave, that they use to charge customers and to pay their drivers are all just numbers in an algorithm somewhere. So if they want to add a dollar to, you know, everybody, every single Uber ride that gets picked up as part of the base fee, and half of that goes to Uber and half of it goes to the driver or whatever. Or they want to gear the algorithm to pay you 79 cents a mile instead of 69 cents a mile or 59 cents a mile so that their costs are lower. That's literally, that's one guy sitting at a computer somewhere. He punches those numbers in and that's it, man. So like you're saying, it's a network, and that gives them, I think, a significant amount of power in being able to kind of fuck with all these little variables. And I think probably to some degree,
but you also wouldn't be surprised if 20 years from now that entire market was dominated by names that weren't even a twinkle in someone's eye yet.
Correct. Yeah, correct.
So 20 years is too long, right? That gets back to the tech guys who are all the same age at the right time at the right moment. So if Uber and Lyft are too early,
yeah, then they turn
survive.
Into
they won't make it. Right?
They turn into Napster or MySpace,
or they'll get, well, Napster's a great example. I actually mentioned it the other day. Napster got tamed, right? Napster was this renegade company that I don't know where they actually went, but now it's iTunes, right? Now it's totally you know central to the system. The Napster idea. Instead of it being theft, it's $1.99 or whatever the hell they charge. I don't use it, that type of stuff, but I think something like Uber will do that. I don't know. I can't get my brain around buying investments that don't have real cash flow, not just the fake stuff. And I don't want to buy a company that makes money because it gets a tax rebate that somehow makes it look like it's making money. I happen to notice the Uber. Was the Uber burning $2 billion a year or something? Is it Uber that's burning $2 billion a year?
Probably.
$1.8 And then you just by chance you go on the Yahoo message board, Yahoo finance board, and it says it's got a PE of 20. I go, okay, that works. You have PE of 20 with a $2 billion a year cash burn, right?
Russ Gerber said yesterday that Tesla has a PE of zero.
Right. So, yeah, there's a good friend.
There's a lot of interesting people out there.
Yeah, so Ross Gerber. I don't know. There's people who think Ross Gerber's not a real person, not a real analyst. They think he's an actor.
No,
I'm not kidding. There's people who think he's just out there. He's paid to spew. And he's got a good, he at one point made reference to when Tesla was tanking, he said they broke through support.
Yeah.
He's going, Dude, that's not breaking through support. Resistance.
He said resistance.
Yeah, they broke through resistance. He said, that's not breaking through resistance. That's breaking through support, right? I had it backwards, but I'm a fool, so he's not supposed to be. But I think he is. I don't know. I'm watching companies, and I hope to buy companies that get sold because people are illiquid and that you know, crank out, you know, X dollars per year per share and give it to me. And that's what I'm going to be looking for, is meat and potato stuff, boring stuff, Warren Buffett stuff. And the fear I have, my big fear is that instead of going from projectile vomit V-bounce, that the next one is going to do what it should have done in 2008-2009, and that is to tank and then stumble along the bottom for a while and to regroup, but instead the Feds got involved. So I think next time it might do that. So
we're due, aren't we?
Well, we're due. My biggest fear is that they just, all the assets just stay up and your return will just be so mediocre, you know, net negative for so long that we'll all just die.
Yeah. Well, active managers will wind up, you know, back in favor again.
Well, I guess, but I'm not sure if there's anyone smart enough to negotiate that either. Right. I mean, if the assets are really overpriced, you know, an active manager's fees will take out the advantage. I'm just you will find active managers who are great, but you're just getting fooled by randomness.
Well, so, I think in a market that's stagnating, you're still going to have outliers, right? You're still going to have stuff that gets too expensive.
Right, but the outliers are coin tossers, right? If there's 10,000 active managers, and the 80% suck, you're still going to have a handful that look like rocket surgeons, right? You're gonna have a bunch who look smart just because the coin tossed, you know, the 4-to-1 improbable coin toss flipped 10 times in a row, right? on a bell curve, a statistical bell curve, you're going to get outliers, right? Michael Jordan is just part of a bell curve. You know, a bell curve without a Michael Jordan is the one that doesn't make sense.
It's not a bell curve, right?
Right. And, you know, Bill Miller beat the S&P 13 years in a row and then gave it all back, right?
Right.
And he gave it all back. He didn't just give a bunch back. And, you know, I've had arguments with people about hot streaks in basketball. Statisticians say they don't exist. And it's not to say that you don't have hot streaks, but they're not – they're statistically normal hot streaks.
Right.
They're just coin tosses. And so I'm not sure the money managers are any better than that. They don't. And then I posed a question on Twitter the other day that I got a bunch of shallow answers, which I expect, of course. But I said, how is it possible that we got to the end of a 10-year bond bull market? We get to the end of a 10-year stock roid rage, a real serious run, and all the pension funds are still in a world of trouble, right? And it's an interesting question because they should be doing okay. They could be at great risk of not doing okay, but if bonds have soared, now you're in trouble because now you can't get yield, right? But your 10-year bond should have been kicking out steady money and the value of your portfolio should have been going up, right? Et cetera, et cetera. So that's a bond bull market of 10 years. It's at the end, by definition almost. And the equity market is beyond imagination. So how are the pension funds all screwed up? And I asked, and everyone came up with dumbs, or should I say partial answers. I said, well, they didn't allocate enough. I said, I don't care. They'd still be doing okay with that kind of a run. And they'd say, you know, their assumptions are wrong. I go, you don't need assumptions for that kind of a run, right? That kind of run followed their stupid assumption.
Right.
So what was it? And then Chris Martinson came along and said, well, by the way, we just interviewed someone who explained this. And it turns out it was a forensic accountant / lawyer type. And he says that within all the pensions, not just Kentucky. You remember they did a Frontline episode on Kentucky's pension fund. It's funded 22%, right? They're broke. They got nothing. The moonshiners of Kentucky basically got hoodwinked. And the front line was boring to the extent that it made it look like just a bunch of hicks from Kentucky getting hoodwinked. And you go, that's not an interesting story. But it showed you how unprepared the people kind of overseeing the pension were to handle the Wall Street shenanigans, right?
Right.
And so it turns out that this guy talks about that. And he I don't know for sure. He sounded like he was really in the thick of things, this guy that Martinson interviewed, a guy named Seidel. And he said that's happening to all the pensions. So Wall Street's taken something that's crap. They might have some stuff they know is worth zero, and they're dumping it into the pension.
Sure.
But it's worse than that. He said there are you can find accounts in the Cayman Islands that don't have any money in them. Right? They're literally so you can have something where the pension's getting 10% of what it's supposed to be getting. It's that level of criminality. And it's because no one's driving the cab on the pensions. They're overseen by just idiots.
Well,
and that's just a shooting fish in a barrel. So Wall Street has gutted the pensions.
We're going to get exactly what we deserve with that. And I think you're 100% right. That unfortunately, the people that have paid into these pensions are truly going to wind up being victims of
destitute.
It's going to be horrifying. I mean, it's going to be horrifying. And what their answer is now, okay, is issuing bonds to turn around and try and reinvest in the stock market to, you know, for like a carry trade to try and earn more in the market than whatever their interest expense is going to be from the bonds that they issued. But they're doing it at the top of, you know, a 10-year bull market, which is an insane thing to do.
Right, and they're probably short-duration bonds, too. They're probably...
And that problem is compounded by exactly what you just said, which is not just portfolio managers, pension portfolio managers that don't know what the fuck they're doing, but a whole industry. Look, you have the people in the industry, like you say, the bell curve, right? The people that are extremely sharp in this industry, the hedge fund managers, the, you know, whatever they are, the guys that run the businesses that are getting paid personally, regardless of what happens, that are looking out for their own self-interest, you know, many of whom run successful businesses. Some of them let their businesses fail and wind up enriching themselves. But those, I mean, those are the people kind of with the sharp elbows. They can be ethically and morally dubious people, but those people are getting paid. And then you have the whole meat of this bell curve of people who are just kind of, they just don't really get it, Dave. You know, they just, I mean, there are people out there overseeing billions of dollars that turn around and look at an IPO like Uber, and they're like, oh, yeah, my son uses Uber, you know? Like, they don't look at the financials. They don't understand how the market works. They don't understand that we're at the top of a cycle that should have never even happened to begin with. You know, they don't,
they shouldn't be broke now is the problem.
Right, right.
So if the pensions were fully funded, I would still be screaming at the top of my lungs. I'd be saying, look, in 3 years, you could be half funded. But they're not fully funded, and that's the thing that I couldn't get my brain around, because all those micro explanations, they didn't add enough, they made bad assumptions, none of them explained it to me, because what was already in the portfolio should have been ripping along, and the fact of the matter is that's where the gap was, is the stuff in the portfolio was not returning squat. And so here's a question. When Enron went down, who lost? Who lost all that money, right? Or when someone says, you know, remember when the head of CEO of Citigroup said, we're hedged, right? Of course, they ended up getting bailed out. They ended up being totally insolvent. But when Citigroup says we're hedged, the question is, by whom? The Klingon Empire? who? So when all these guys are hedged, all these gigabuck owners are hedged.
Who's the counterparty?
Who are the losers on the hedges? I think that the answer is hedge funds. Not hedge funds, pension funds. I think the pension funds are being stuffed with these stupid goddamn hedges. And then all of a sudden, you know, duck feet, the people put their palms up and said, don't blame me. It's a bad market. We're in a recession.
Nowhere in the sea of failing pension funds and in the sea of local municipalities and statewide budgets, with everybody running a deficit, nobody amongst that whole sea of people has, even up to the federal government, has considered the idea of, hey, maybe we should just spend a little bit less and, you know, take the medicine a little bit. We have just gotten so, even in something in the case where, you know, I forget when I was watching Chris Christie like 10 years ago, trying to reason with teachers at a town hall about, you know, he was trying to write the budget one way or the other, I think regarding the teacher's pension. I can't remember exactly what it was, and I can't remember exactly what he was proposing, but it seemed like a common sense, you know, hey, you know, we're just, you're going to get paid $8.80 out of every dollar, and, you know, you'll be able to keep all your other benefits and stuff, but, you know, we have a deficit, and, you know, certain things just have to get cut, and that's how it is, and, you know, otherwise the state's going to go bankrupt, and nobody's going to get anything, and the outrage that he got just from that. It's just people, they don't understand it. They don't understand, you know, from a financial perspective, what needs to be done and really what the old school right answers are. But before the days of MMT, I mean, if you were broke, the answer used to be just save fucking money and don't spend any of it, right? I mean, that was the way to get. Now it's, you know, anything but that. Now it's spend more, you know.
Well, so you know the cities that are broke are supposed to, the municipalities and cities and states are supposed to go through Chapter 9 bankruptcy, right? So there've been a number of attempts in which they've tried to cut off the pensioners, and the courts have ruled no. And people think the courts are being obstructionist because they're saying, well, you know, what are we supposed to do? And the answer is Chapter 9 bankruptcy. The courts are saying you can't do it this way. You can't screw pensioners selectively. You have to declare bankruptcy, and that's what they're avoiding. The fact that Chicago and Illinois and stuff haven't declared bankruptcy yet just shows you that the inertia. You will wait to declare bankruptcy until there's nothing.
They just issued a bond, didn't they?
I know. They did. But there'll be nothing left, right? There'll be
scorched earth.
Oh my God, these covenant light loans, where basically you think you know, you're first in line to get paid off, and then all of a sudden what you discover is that the way your loan was written is you get subordinated by someone else lending them money, and next thing you know, you're owning stuff, you're way down the food chain. And so there's a ton of those that are sort of marketable because of the yield seeking behavior going on. So when it comes time to pay off the creditors, right? Bankruptcy is a simple concept. It basically is when you say, look, there's not enough to go around. And so you split it up fairly. That's what a bankruptcy court's about. You say, okay, you got all these creditors. For every dollar that's owed, there's only 40 cents left. And so we're going to divide it up this way. And the problem is you can't just hose the pensioners and say, you know, you're not getting any so that we can stay solvent. You gotta go through the bankruptcy. And I think there's going to be a whole industry of bankruptcy lawyers to sort through this mess.
There's going to have to be.
Right, there's going to have to be. Kentucky is 22% funded. They have to get a five bagger on their portfolio to get back to even. The odds of that are zero.
It's over,
especially
right.
Given that, especially since they had a 1/5 bagger on the way down. Right.
Right, and these are PMs that only know how to go long stuff at the top of a 10-year bull market.
Right. Right. So I don't know. So the Fed's terrified of the next recession, legitimately.
With bonds paying dick, by the way, and inflation about to tick up.
I guess, you know, at this point, I've given up thinking I know what or when. I'm getting to the point where I won't propose what or when. But,
well, it's happening. Like Peter Schiff says, just, you know, look at the price you pay for a magazine today versus what you paid for it 2 years ago, 3 years ago. You know, instead of looking at the CPI number, which is a carefully selected group of products,
right.
You know, just look at something you've been buying for the last 10, 15 years and just do a comparison that way. And you'll see really costs rise. What the hell was I just watching? I was just watching today a video on, I think it was like one of the Bloomberg TikTok videos. Oh, you know what it was? It was a commercial last night during the basketball game for SoFi, which is one of these peer-to-peer lenders. And the commercial starts with running through the gripes of, you know, the economy today because things are so awful, right? After 10 years of the stock market doing nothing but going up, the commercial starts by saying, you know, how did we get into all this debt? People of your generation, you know, you've got credit card debt, you got student loan debt. People are working two jobs, and one of the things they say, Dave, is the price of housing is at an all-time high. The cost of living is at an all-time high. They listed like three or four instances of where prices have risen, and you know they're using that as the basis to pitch their loans as relief, their low-interest loans. But you just stop, and I was listening to it last night, and I'm like, the fucking problem, this is a very basic thing that they're getting right. The problem is prices are going up. Prices are getting away from people. Why do people still think that items costing more on the daily is some type of benefit? It doesn't make any sense, right? The price of computers comes down. The price of cell phones comes down.
You got the Fed promoting inflation like it's a good thing, which shows you that they should probably all be euthanized because they're too stupid to exist. But or they think we are. Right.
Well,
no, I'm not.
That might be it.
So they're promoting this idea that inflation's too low. We've been hearing that for 10 years. Right now, you got the Brainerd. There's a metaphor. Brainerd out there saying that that we got to let inflation run hotter. Oh, that's great. I there's nothing I like doing is paying more for shit. And then you've got that was a paper out of the IMF, I think, or one of those, and another paper out of the St. Louis Fed, where they're talking about, you know, going to a cashless society to give them the power to drive interest rates decidedly negative because cash protects you from a negative interest rate, a deeply negative interest rate. Just go to cash. And I put out a tweet that said, look, you know, you're going to be hanging upside down like Mussolini, and you're going to have time to ponder why the populace doesn't like negative interest rates and a cashless society. And I think they're pushed. I think – can you imagine if you're sitting there and you're getting negative 5% on your money and you've got a positive inflation rate? It'll be so transparently obvious – that you're getting screwed. And so yellow vests
no,
will
it
come
won't.
Out.
I mean, not to everybody, it won't.
No, negative interest rate, yes, it will. That's the problem with negative rates, is that the average person can see that the money is disappearing on them. They can't see. When inflation's 4% and they're getting paid 2%, they don't understand they're losing two.
Right, that it's a bad carry trade.
The rates are negative, not real rates. Nominal rates are negative. Any nitwit can see they're losing. And so if they go there, I think there's going to be mayhem. And we're not going to win, right? There's never revolutions rarely, if ever, produce a better end result, at least not in the short term.
Think about the risk that we incur if we go to a cashless society, right?
Oh, it's awful.
And we don't even have to print the money anymore. I mean, at least now we're limited by, you know, the physics and the amount of sheets of paper that can actually fly off these presses.
Well,
and the
but
dollar,
it's not just and that. It's the freedom. It's a civil liberty that you can spend some money without anyone knowing what you're spending.
Wait. That's a totally other issue. I mean, I agree with you wholeheartedly, but I'm just saying, imagine if somebody could just hit a button, and you know, there's a trillion, there's 10 trillion. I mean, the moral hazard.
They can. No, they did. They can hit a button.
That is true. But I mean, go ahead.
The problem with the cashless society is that once it's cashless, you are by definition have every penny, every bit of your money in the banking system, every bit. You don't have even any in your wallet. And so the macroeconomists say, and what's great about that is now we can use negative interest rates as a monetary policy. And I'm going, give me a fucking gun, you asshole. I'm taking you out. You're just an idiot. And then you say, well, but I've heard people defend negative rates. I go, you guys are idiots. You don't know what you're doing, and you want to drive rates negative, which is not a free market phenomenon at all. And then the question I ask rhetorically, how negative do you want to go? 5%, 10%, 20%. Once you've got a cashless society, you got nothing to protect you. And that's when the Second Amendment kicks in.
Right.
That's when you wish you owned guns and you're going to goddamn go deal with someone and you're not going to get the right person. And it's just going to be mayhem.
Well, I don't even think people can extrapolate it that far, right? When I think about... So let me unpack a couple things there. The first is... You know, taking away the civil liberties in a cashless society, and I completely 100% agree with you. Okay, the idea of having everything tracked and everything followed and everything accounted for, and not being able to turn to you and say, "Hey, Dave, here's 100. Fucking give me the New York Jets -3.5, and let's just keep it between me and you." The idea of that going away is absolutely frightening, and of course we are heading in that direction. Unfortunately, regardless. I think if we had a cashless society, people would just start to, we would go back to gold or something. You know, there would have to be some physical instrument that we could transact to keep things out of the system. You know, people aren't just going to give up on that. I think, you know, we would go back to gold coins, or we would go back to silver. There would have to be some type of commodity. Anyways, that's number one. What the hell was the second thing you just said?
That there'll be mayhem.
Oh, yeah, exactly. You know, I was never, you know, I grew up in a household that, you know, we didn't have it. We didn't own guns. We weren't gun advocates. You know, I grew up thinking to myself, like, why would anybody need a gun? And I didn't get it. You know, I understood hunting. Okay. Like I understood kind of guns for sport. And when I moved to South Philadelphia, and shacked up by myself, I started to understand, all right, like, well, I'm not a total psychopath. Like, I'm a normal person, but I'm, you know, I used to carry a knife with me, right? Because I bartended for a long time, and I would always carry this knife with me every night because I'd be walking home down 11th Street at 3:30 or 4 o'clock in the morning, which is not a terribly bad area, but walking from Center City all the way down south of Washington Avenue in Philadelphia, there's, you know, you play good block, bad block in a couple spots. You used to, at least. Now it's a little bit better. And I always carried a knife with me. And then when I got home, I had this big, you know, machete at my house. And I was like, I figured if somebody comes in, I chop their fucking nuts off, and that'll be that. And
that hurt.
you know, I started to think then, like, oh, all right, like, this makes sense now. Like, you know, I don't want to die, so maybe I own a gun just to protect myself, and I just leave it here next to the bed, and I never have to use it. And I go out, and I shoot a couple days, you know, every few months, and I stay proficient, and that's it, you know? And then I start learning about economics, and then you start learning about macro, and then you start learning about, you know, the Austrian school, and you start learning about what the Fed's doing, and you start to really think about, at least for me, Dave, I start to extrapolate some situations and circumstances in my head where shit could really hit the fan. And again, I think to myself, like I know it's not going to happen, probably not in my lifetime, but, you know, if I'm sitting on physical bullion or whatever, my life, whatever's in my house that I own that I want to protect, right? How am I going to protect that if this shit hits the fan? And
you're probably going to get your ass blown off by a much better armed band.
Yeah.
But at least you go down with a fight.
Yeah, I get that one shot in, exactly.
I'm listening to the audiobook by Jonah Goldberg, and it's some suicide of I can't remember the title, but it's Jonah Goldberg's most recent book, and he talks about the natural order of humans is tribal and violent, and that we have to keep reminding ourselves every generation that we've got it made, and that we've got to remind ourselves that what we have here is good, and what got us here, and not lose sight of that. He clearly is troubled by the fact that there's a serious rotting of attitudes about what got us here and what made us prosper, and what an odd coincidence of factors got us to this point of tremendous prosperity, and how we're at great risk of losing it. He's not the only one. I remember I read a book by Tony Blankley that was in, I think, maybe 06 or something, and it was all about it was called The West's Last Chance, and it was about basically the clash of cultures in Europe. And he described a hypothetical of 2009, right? It's now in our rearview mirror, of the battle of, you know, Christians versus Islam in Europe. And now you look what's going on in Europe, and you go, holy shit, that's kind of happening, right? And I don't know where this is all going to go, but I do know that people can get angry and get crazy and violent and stupid and all the stuff that you think is in the rearview mirror now. It'll resurface fast. And
well,
the yellow vests are hint of it. Antifa's hints of it. You could argue the Proud Boys are hints of it. Although I'm more sympathetic to them in general. I just probably labeled myself a Nazi by mistake. But in any case.
Well, I think part of the self-fulfilling prophecy is that the way people are being raised and the way that universities are conditioning people that are, you know, coming of age, that are late teens and early 20s, is to not bear personal responsibility in all instances or at all, you know, blame the fucking issue on the system, which, look, I like to blame the system for a lot of things, right? But also, you know, if I go out and I take a loan and I don't pay it back, you know, it's not the government's fault. I mean, it's my fault, right? I mean, so on a microcosm level, I look at it from a personal responsibility standpoint. I just feel like we're being conditioned. This goes back to what I was saying about people not being able to be comfortable with making these common sense, you know, budget cuts for the greater good, because we've just been so conditioned to be so comfortable, right? Everything's got to be comfortable. And that is a self-fulfilling prophecy that leads us further down a path to an area where a lot of people are going to become very uncomfortable, maybe in very short order at some point. And this idea of, you know, not being able to take responsibility for yourself and rather turning around and looking to point the blame and say, well, here's where I should get bailed out, or here's where I should, you know, here's what, you know, what I fell victim to. And yeah, there's some bad things out there, right? But that attitude becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy, and a lot of it comes down to this conditioning that everybody needs to be comfortable all the time. Everybody, you know, we've swung so. I read an article yesterday about a man that transitioned to a woman and broke 5 powerlifting records in a day. You know, five women's powerlifting records, and I'm like, that's because biologically that's not a woman. So, you know, I feel like the gate has has swung.
So here's the ultra stupid part of that. So I'm surrounded by this. But, although, you know, I got to tell you, you don't see it in a day in, day out. But I'm sitting in the chem department. You don't see it in chemistry. You pick up maybe subtle little hints where some kid gets a little whiny or something. You go over to the art squad where the humanists are. I think that's where you find the stuff. And even then, I think it's minority rule. But yeah, I just finished a book by Heather McDonald called The Diversity Delusion. And she goes through all the stats that show that actually our effort to help the underrepresented are actually hurting the underrepresented.
Right.
She makes a compelling case. And she talks about campuses. She said the kids are not demanding this highly politicized curriculum. It's the faculty. They want to do it. It's not the kids. They want to take real stuff. They want to learn about Plato and Aristotle. They don't want to learn about some person who's irrelevant. And they want to understand the origins of modern civilization, not what someone wants to do to rewrite it. We're heading down this odd path, I admit it.
But you can't push back now, Dave. You can't even push back in a look.
You can better than you could 2 or 3 years ago, right? I wouldn't have said what I just said probably 2 or 3 years ago. I would have thought about it out of fear that there'd be some sort of repercussion. At some level, I've just come to terms with the idea that if someone wants to push back, someone listens to this podcast, wants to throw a shit fit, I'll just go to war with them. I don't care. They want to do it. We'll do it. We'll fight it in the press for all I care. And I've been there before. It's just an idea. I have my ideas. They have their ideas. Theirs are stupid. Mine are smart. That's a different story. But so yes, we're conditioning. There's another thing going on here that it's kind of clicked for me. So the kids are being conditioned in a biochemical way, and this is the model. So you take. You take a young kid whose brain is developing. They develop till they're 25, but it takes a 12-year-old, right? Their brain is going bananas, developmentally speaking. You then give them an iPhone. One of the first things you see is that biochemically they're rewiring so that their peripheral vision is shrinking because they're spending so much time focused on this little phone that they're actually biochemically changing. It's called neuroplasticity, and their peripheral vision is literally shrinking. They because of the way problems are thrown at them at this age, it turns out that their attention span for problem solving is shortening up dramatically. And again, it's not their fault. It's the world that they've been born into. Then you have social media, which beats the shit out of these kids, right? So these kids are getting bombarded with social media. And you can look on social media and find out that there was a party that you didn't get invited to and you feel like a piece of shit. At 12 years old, you feel like a piece of shit most of the time. But it's now worse. And then on top of all that, you throw in the fact that half of them are on ADHD meds.
Right.
So now imagine you put a kid on Ritalin, you hand them a phone, you give them access to social media, right? You're basically wiring a whack job. And then you wonder why the suicide rate is soaring.
Yeah, it's fascinating. I was talking to somebody just a couple of days ago about how the idea of us having this constant access to social media, the constant kind of dependence on the phone, how unnatural that is.
I don't have the phone dependence, but I obviously like Twitter. And the Twitter has it. You know, you're a rat in a cocaine experiment on Twitter, right? You know, you get responses, boom, your brain says, I got a response, right? And Twitter's figured that out. Facebook has figured that out. They know how to get the dopamine and the various neurotransmitters flowing in your brain and clicking away until you're arthritic.
It's so outside of the norm of what, you know, genetically the human element is, right? I mean,
absolutely.
We're animals, right? Supposedly. We like to sleep, we like to have sex, we like to eat.
Supposedly the young adults are not even having as much sex. I'm not sure I believe it. But I went out there on Twitter and said, there was an article that said they're not having anywhere near as much sex. I got to chime in here, guys. You're missing the big picture. This is not a limited resource. Go out there, hump your lights out, because if you think you're going to get married and then have a bunch of sex, you're totally out of your mind. And so do it while you can, right? And then it got a retweet from a monster feeder, right? A real clickbait feed. And I go, holy shit, that thing's going to run. And you know, he said, Cornell professor encouraging students to hump their lights out. I go, great. But it was actually about the millennials. So technically I'm still okay. But these kids, they're not even having sex. Although I'm thinking, but wait a minute, aren't they having sex all the time with their swipe left, swipe right, whatever? I don't know. I don't know what to make of them, right? This is old guys looking at the young saying they're all screwed up, right?
And so why have sex when you can have the dopamine hit from getting the match on Tinder and then just move on to the next, you know? You don't have to get together in person, you know?
I'll tell you what I would have loved. I would have loved to have been able to ask someone out by a text message. A lot goddamn easier, right? You have to face them. You get on the phone. Your voice is shaking. Hot babe on the other end. And you're going, holy shit, I am about to eat it here or score like crazy. And she shoots you down and you go, I just want to die now. Right?
Yeah, I knew that was going to happen.
Hey, can we get together sometime? Get a little subtle hint back, no.
Yeah.
But said in some other way. And you go, I got it. I didn't have to look her in the eye and fall apart, right? And so it's easier in that sense. I don't know. It's a different world. And the other problem is the kids, you can't just go to college and major in some stupid subject and plan on making some money. Those days are over. They never did exist except for during a period where the boom was rolling. I mean,
right.
What people didn't understand was that the boom we just witnessed, a multi-decade boom, was mandated by the demographics of the boomers, right? The guys who know demographics know this. And so as the boomers mowed through their productive years, we're necessarily going to rock and roll. And all sorts of things that look highly productive and functional and doable, as the boomers roll off the other end, you're going to say, wait a minute, that doesn't work anymore. You can't be Henry Blodge and get a bachelor's degree in English and go make $10 million a year analyzing .coms. Those days are over, right?
Yeah, and part of the reason is because everybody has access to university now, you know? Everybody has access to go to college as a result of nationalizing student loans and saying everybody's, you know, we're going to give everybody access to capital to do this. So you flood the colleges with people. Everybody gravitates to these degrees that used to mean something, like communications. You know, you used to actually, you know, you got a communications degree and then you went and worked for a fucking television station. Now it's like, you know, you get a communications degree and you're just part of this amorphous group of people that have kind of degrees, you know?
Right. And so you know, if you're coming out of a college and you go to med school, you're still, by the way, up to your ass in debt. And that world could collapse on itself, too, right? You'd be getting up with socialized medicine all of a sudden out of the blue, right? But, you know, you come out of college with some sort of skill sets, real skill sets, you know, some sort of math science, whatever. There are non-math science things, which are also skill sets. But there's a whole bunch where the question then becomes, okay, take the major. Your parents look at the major. You're thinking of applying to college, or your kids are applying to college. Look at the major and say, okay, free associate now from that major. Name the careers that you would do. And if you can't fire off a bunch of answers to that question, you shouldn't do it. I had another epiphany listening to a podcast. You want to know if a college has gone off the rails? Go look at the curricula of the humanities. And if the curricula of the humanities has sort of what you would expect, so if the studies of antiquities have courses on Plato and have courses on ancient Rome and blah, 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 then the colleges sort of kept its bearings. But if you go to the humanities and you discover various bizarro studies of who cares, then it means that school has lost it, and you should steer your kid away, because it means that the high command at the school lost it. Didn't keep the school focused on what college. So you and I, that's where I would check. The sciences will always look good, right? Relatively. But the humanities is where you're going to see where college is rolled over and become just a mindless, putty-headed bunch of administrators. I blame the administrator. Ultimately, strong leadership at the top will prevent stupid professors from doing stupid things.
And the sciences are very specific disciplines, a lot of them, right? You don't just get a degree in science.
Oh, here's right? one. Yeah, I don't think I talked about it. So I got a, I submitted a paper. It came back with a report probably about a week ago. And the one of the referees challenged me on about five different English usages in the paper. And it's not going to win. So at one point I said, look, to say such and such would be an understatement, right? They took that out, too colloquial. I go, okay, I got it. But they didn't say too colloquial, but they said no place in a scientific paper for that. And I'm going, yeah, you're too boring, right? I'm more. And then I used the word dearth. And I'm going, they didn't like that. And I'm thinking, okay, it's too lofty a word, so I'll take that. I'll put scarcity, right? But the question is, why didn't they like dearth, right? And I think they said it was subjective because I'm actually saying there's a scarcity, and how can I say that? And I'm thinking, well, fuck you. I've been doing this 38 years. I know if there's a scarcity of information on something, right? But then it gets surreal. And one thing they said, I use this phrase where I said, if you add the substituents here and here on the molecule, I said. It has a retarding effect, and they wanted retarding removed. and so I pushed back hard. I eventually wrote a counterattack on this whole referee report and an allergic reaction. I eventually just lost my shit, and I edited the hell out of it, but I didn't. I just said, nope, I'm not conceding these points to this goddamn person. And I said, please, I pray that you are not saying I can't use the word retarding because it has the root retard. And I said, please, please, please do not let this crap get into the sciences. But I think they did.
Of course.
And I think they were word managing shit like crazy. And I'm going, you know what this is? This is not the scientist who the editor thinks this is a prominent scientist. This is a student or a postdoc of a prominent scientist.
Right.
And this is a young generation person saying, you can't use a word with the root retard in it because that's politically incorrect. I'm going, you know what you are?
You're a retard.
One of those guys. Right? It is so stupid. I'm not putting up with that crap. So I pushed back hard. I told the editor that I shit my pants basically when I read that.
It's just insane. This is what I mean.
Dave is entering the sciences. I'll end up in a fight with someone, right? If they want to push back, I'm ready to do battle. I'm ready to sit in front of a tribunal and say, here is why this person is a moron. Here is why you shouldn't tolerate this crap. And someone's got to fight the fight. So
when I was in fifth grade, I lost a spelling bee. I came in second. In my school, we had a like school-wide spelling bee, and I was standing to see like who went to nationals or whatever, you know, it was me and this other kid who was just a genius, and the word I lost on was gaiety. G-A-I-E-T-Y, I think. I still don't know how to spell it.
Right.
But I'm just thinking, like, could you imagine if that happened today? People would be like, oh my God, like, you can't.
You can't say gaiety. I don't know. Actually, you can, right? I mean, I don't know what you can say. I don't know. My goal is to not say something that will cause someone to be hurt.
Right.
Who's not a douchebag.
Right.
Right? If they're a douchebag, I can't avoid hurting them. If they're a douchebag, then I can't stop. There's nothing I can do. You know, get professional help. I don't care.
I was just in Atlantic City a couple days ago, and at Bally's, the casino, they had a big area that they're breaking off, I guess, and they're turning into a sports book because they just enabled sports gambling. So they have these big...
Because they're going broke, you mean?
Probably, yeah. They have these big, huge, giant, giant panels that go up to these, like, you know, 100-foot ceilings in Bally's and these big drapes. And every one of them that's draped down and in big, like, you know, 20-foot letters just says, fire retardant. On it, like, you know, I walk past.
Oh yeah,
it,
right? I can't use that one anymore.
You can't say that. You have to say.
Well, the other thing
I'm
so
mentally
confounded
challenged
by. You know, I started to talk about this before, but I'm confounded by the hypocrisy. So I'm confounded by, you know, the left who tolerates Bill Clinton, right?
Right.
And who who apologizes for him basically raping various women. I'm confounded by the feminists who will not denounce that region of the Islamic world who chucks gays off roofs.
Right.
Right? And they don't even want to say it. Look, you chuck gays off roofs, I will chuck you off a roof. Right? I'm confounded by the left who doesn't stand up and fight like crazy against genital mutilation occurring within the United States. That, where are they? We can have a debate about whether a parent has the right to mutilate their daughter's genitals, but they're not even fighting. Right? I'm a believer that parents have an awful lot of rights to do shit like letting them walk to school unattended and blah, blah, blah. But someone ought to be fighting about this question whether you get to mutilate some girl's genitals.
Yeah,
because right? In the world that we live in now, that would be child abuse. The kids would be yanked from the home and they'd be put in a foster home until they figured out what to do with those goddamn parents. But it's going on in the United States, and the people who should be fighting it are mum.
Yeah, well, there's,
where are they?
There's a lot of hypocrisy across a multitude of issues.
And you're a power lifter. You're a power lifter, right? Now, oh, yeah, yeah, I know. We have to be fair to the transgender, whatever. And I'm going, what about the goddamn girls who've worked their entire life to achieve something and their parents who drove them to 5 a.m. practices and all that, and they get a participation trophy?
Because some
testosterone-infested kid who looks like a beast.
Right?
And I'm going, how is that fair? By the way, I don't want to see women and girls in the boys' sports either. They don't need to – you want to do a sport – do the girl sports, let the boys do the boy sports. You know why? Because what will happen is some girl will play football, some guy will put a helmet right in her back, and guess what? He's in trouble.
Right.
Right? So I just let them play chess against each other. I used to help coach taekwondo, girls, boys, sparred, no problem. No problem. They didn't compete.
Right.
Right? It wasn't open competition. I could spar with a 5-year-old, for Christ's sakes.
Right.
But Title IX paid a dear price in men's sports so that women could have women's sports strong. And I drive by the sports field and they're out there playing field hockey, out there playing lacrosse, and I'm thinking, this is great. This might have been worth the pain. And I really didn't like it because I was a gymnast at one point and gymnastics got annihilated, wrestling got annihilated at great cost. But the women's sports look great to me, and now they're going to screw it all up.
And it just doesn't make sense. I mean, you can – what people don't understand, I don't think, Dave, is that they can be for equality. You can be for equality, but that door can swing too far in the other direction, right?
Yeah,
like,
that's right.
I want –
No one even has the guts to say this is stupid.
Right.
And virtue signaling drives me nuts. You know what you're virtue signaling, right? You're sitting there going, yeah, I think we got to worry about this. You're lying your ass off, right? When someone's virtue signaling is lying your ass off. And there's actually a psychiatrist or psychologist who calls it the sneaky fucker syndrome. And the origin of the phrase is you're trying to get laid. And you're trying to get laid by convincing the women that you're on their team.
Right.
And so I hate virtue signaling. I can't stand virtue signaling because you're lying your ass off.
Well, exactly. Exactly. Exactly.
Right.
I mean, and that's – we all knew that guy, right? That would go –
that guy, they're everywhere now.
Right, right.
They're everywhere now.
And I think
– we all do it a little bit, but some of it's just disgusting.
I can't speak for women, and I'm not going to speak for women. I was raised in a household with a very powerful and very intelligent mother who was, as far as I'm concerned, as good as it gets out of both sexes, and also, very, very dedicated and very selfless and just incredible father. I mean, I was raised in a great household, and, to me... In terms of, I can't speak for women, but I just don't know that I don't know if that's what would appeal to a woman, somebody that's feigning kind of, you know, like you're saying, virtue signaling.
That's a fascinating question.
Right.
And I think what it is so society, one time I was at a meeting years ago, it was before this became common, and I was acting like myself. And at one point, some chick clears her throat a little bit on me. And afterwards, I went on the side, I said, you know, I could change the way I act in your presence. Is that what you'd like? And she thinks about it. She says, no.
Right.
That's the million-dollar question. Is it fair for a young woman to walk in the room and have the conversation change because she's present? And the answer, in my opinion, is no. And it's not, you know, you could make the argument, you don't have to be a complete dirtball, right? I probably acted like enough of a dirtball that I offend guys, for Christ's sakes. But somehow, I think it's fair to present the same persona to everybody at some
sure.
level.
Sure, and I think that you can do that to a degree, and I also think that you can curb kind of, you know, where how far you go across the line. Or, you know, you can kind of squelch yourself to some degree, like the way
yeah,
that
but
I.
So here's the deal.
But
so
for the most part,
for
the most part, Dave, if I'm going to sit down and have a conversation with both of my parents at the table, I'm going to speak the exact same way I'm speaking now. If I'm going to go out and I'm going to take a woman out on a date, you know, am I going to extend to her a certain level of respect that I extend to? That I don't extend to anybody else? Yeah, maybe slightly, you know, like I
yeah,
like,
that's the game, dude.
But
it's not like she didn't put on lipstick either.
right, exactly. But I mean, it's not like I'm not going to go and say, oh, you know, like for instance, let's look at the idea that we just brought up of the power lifter. You know, I'm not going to go out on a date and say, "Oh, I think that's so wonderful that they're giving him, her, or whatever he or she would like to be called a shot at doing that." To me, that's still not going to make sense. I'm going to be like,
"No, not a bit." A
man into a woman's powerlifting competition and they break 5 records in the first day. I mean, this is just ruining everything. It doesn't make any sense.
And by the way, it's never going to work in the long term if that opinion offends her. So you try to not show her all the awful shit.
Right.
But if you're not showing people who you are in some sort of somewhat reasonable way, they're eventually going to figure you out anyway.
Well, and
you're not getting anywhere.
You're doing yourself a disservice, right?
The fear is that this young damsel's thinking, holy shit, I'm only seeing the tip of the iceberg.
Right.
Right? That's the risk. So you got to assume that she's assuming you're covering up some shit, so you better behave yourself at some level. But you know, my wife, I've slowly but surely gotten her used to me. It took a long, long time. I mean, she and I are just such polar opposites. I have trouble shocking her now. You know, I throw shit around. You know, she hated the word balls. And I can now refer to sucking salty balls, and she doesn't care. But it's taken years to condition her. Years and years of civil libertarian, you know, the do I have the right to fart in bed, or does she have the right to not stew in bed?
I think it all comes kind of from the
constitutional crisis,
right? Well, it all comes kind of from the root of what you believe in general in terms of civil liberties, right? I mean, do you believe in everybody's right to free speech? Do you believe in, you know, it's like a free market, right? If you let everybody out there and you let them all say exactly what they want to say and you don't curb anybody's speech, regardless of how insane it may appear to be in one direction or the other, eventually that person will make their way through the free market of other individuals and find like-minded individuals and somebody to go to lunch with and somebody to go to bed with and whatever. And the people that disagree or can't stand it will go in the opposite direction. And you know, I used to dye my hair all these crazy colors when I was in college. People used to ask me, like, why the fuck do you do that? And I'd be like, you know what? It filters out a lot of people that I know I wouldn't want to talk to begin with. Because if people come up to me and they want to have a conversation with me because I have, you know, cheetah print color hair, they're probably not the people I wanted to talk to begin with. And to some degree, it kind of works like that, right? I mean, if you either you're going to have civilized discourse with somebody or you're not going to, you know, regardless of what your views are. And I find that, to be honest with you, you know, I find that on the left, people are a little bit more geared toward responding emotionally and shutting down the idea of having a civil dialogue about whatever the issue at bar is, the controversial issue.
At least now. That may be a relatively new phenomenon. I'm not sure that's always been the case. I have a friend who's super left, super left. We can sit there for hours, you know, discussing, battling, you know, matching war stories, flashing our swords at each other, and never does it go bad, because he and I both have the capacity to somehow sort of find that middle ground and concede it when a point, you know, nice punch, right? It's like sparring in Taekwondo. Oh, nice kick. You know, my ribs are going to feel it tomorrow, but that was really good, right? And so I don't know. This will cycle. One possibility is this. I don't know if your readers, you know, are up on this one, but the fourth turning, the book, it's soft science, it's soft soggy social science, but I think it's not a bad description of what we might be observing, and that is that every 80 or so years society loses its shit completely and goes off the rails, and you have Salem witch trials and crap like that, and we could be in one of those. We could be in for a number of years of just pandemonium. And certainly the left and the right, look at the abortion debate. What a great example. So we went from having a fairly meta-stable discussion, right? There are people who didn't like abortion, people who were pro-choice, but it was calm, right? It was calm. And now you got guys who are saying, you know, abortion can't be past 6 weeks, which is impractical. And you got people saying you should be able to abort a child during contractions, which is, you know, I'm a pro-choice guy, that's genocide. Why is it going to the two extremes, right? What is going on here, right? We weren't having these fights a couple of years ago. And now we are. And I think the activists have grabbed a hold of the two standards. And one of them is running towards no abortion, and one of them is running towards, you know, 60th trimester abortions of their children. And so, it seems like everything is going to the polls. Every debate's going to the polls. You know, you either like Trump or you hate him. You're not allowed to just say he's kind of interesting.
Right. Yeah, you got to be for him or against him.
Yeah, I'm an open Trump supporter. And being on a campus, that makes me a person of one. and I'm happy to do it because I'm happy to discuss it. It certainly triggers conversations. They go, oh, but he's a whack job. Oh, yeah, of course. Yeah, there's no question. Right? So they can't knock me down by declaring he's a whack job. And I go, yeah, and Hillary's a whore, right? So what? I can have these discussions.
It's interesting.
I couldn't walk across campus with a MAGA hat without getting the fuck beat out of me.
It's interesting when you start to kind of pick and choose where you stand on issues and you realize, oh, I'm not really cut from the liberal cloth, or I'm not really cut from the Republican cloth. And like, that was one of the reasons that I started to kind of embrace libertarianism when I was figuring out what it was and trying to, you know, develop some type of political identity, much to, you know, my chagrin. I wasn't really interested in developing a political identity. And that apathy also led me toward, you know, libertarianism. And
yeah, we talked about this before. I, the two parties look like losers. You know, the guys in the top positions. I just finished the book Smear, which is by Cheryl Atkinson. And she talks about the smear complex, billions of dollars spent a year smearing people. And she basically comes to the conclusion that anything you read is there for a reason. It's not there by chance. And that all the op-eds and all the articles and everything has behind it a professional smear campaign.
Right.
Doing it. That the whole media is that. And you can see it when you watch CNN or Fox or whatever. But it's everywhere. And then you start noticing. I mean, I always notice this, but you start noticing the hallmarks. She goes through the various mechanics of it, and how they do it, and how they spread it, and how they get it to go viral. And you can see it. You can see it. And she's kind of 75-25 weighted right versus left. So if you're a lefty, you probably wouldn't like the book as much as if you're right. But it's not you know, hyperbolic right wing. So I think a lefty who's open-minded could read the book and say, you know, this is instructive. And it was a very, so one thing she did is she dug through WikiLeaks. And maybe someone else did this for her, I don't know. But she dug through WikiLeaks and she found a whole ton of exchanges between journalists and politicians that show that there's just this twisted relationship between them where there's just no journalists left, no politicians who don't have journalists in their pockets at all times, right. And all the quid pro quos and stuff. And so when you read an article about Hillary or about Trump or about anyone, it's all orchestrated. So it leaves me sort of unclear as to how to figure out what's true and what's not. It's really a difficult situation for me.
Yeah, it's I don't really know what to make of it. It's so much easier now. Here's what I'm trying to say. It's so much easier now, first off, especially in the realm of social media. And this is what we're just starting to see now, what with, you know, Facebook selling data to people. And there was just an article a couple days ago I read about some, you know, social media or influencer organization interfering with another election somewhere in Nigeria. I can't remember, but they, you know, they bought $1 million worth of ad space and they started, you know, I mean, it's everywhere. And the fact that everybody's glued to their phones and, like you've said, have lost their peripheral vision and that's the only thing that they're focused on, that people are buying exactly what they're being told immediately without doing any type of fact checking. I mean, that's also going the way of the buffalo.
Well, I tell you the one that I think that's starting to pick up legs and looks like it's going to go somewhere real potentially is the backlash to the collusion story, which obviously was a big hoax.
Right.
But the backlash looks like it's picking up speed. And how do you know? Well, it turns out there's all sorts of articles out there where Comey's pointing at Brennan and Brennan's pointing at Loretta Lynch. They are turning on each other.
And now, Mueller just say he's not going to testify now?
He's not going to testify, which I think is fantastically interesting. I don't know what it means, but it's fascinating. But I think Barr, who I find to be very impressive, I think Barr is actually going to look into this. And I think they're going to start shooting each other. And I think there's a very dirty group. And I'm not sure they're all dirty, but because they're telling opposite stories out there right now. So someone is necessarily lying, and possibly all of them for all we know. But I think that could really unravel. And if we really find out that they broke all sorts of laws to spy on Trump, that could blow the hell up real fast.
And it's just another perfect example. It's like, yeah, like you said, is Trump, you know, deranged? Yeah, he is deranged.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
There's no doubt about that. But you can say that Trump's deranged without orchestrating a whole other campaign that's, you know, possibly and potentially illegal in nature and doing, you know, because when you're armed with what you think is the altruistic and virtuistic standpoint, you know, the people on the far, far left think that it's just carte blanche. You know, they can't. It's like the guy that threw
a fucking
milkshake at Nigel Farage the other day. You know, like, regardless of whether you like Nigel Farage or not, you know, you can't assault him. You know, like,
I know.
Doesn't fucking matter. You know, like, you can't.
So my wife was watching MSNBC the other day. My wife's a left-leaning environmentalist. You know, not extreme, but certainly not a lot of overlap with me on that stuff. And she said she was watching MSNBC the other day, and this is the first time she's ever said anything like this. She said the level of disrespect for Trump was disgusting.
Right.
And she said he's president of the United States.
Right.
And I've been trying to sort of tell her that this is what's happening. And by the way, I think the right did it to Obama. I didn't care because I didn't dislike Obama.
They did. I didn't dislike him either. But you remember, like, when he saluted the guy the one time with the Starbucks cup in his hand, it was a whole, you know, like.
I mean, yeah, but these are pretty minor things.
Right,
too.
Of course.
And he got, I just heard this, he got hammered for saying the Constitution is just a piece of parchment. But it was part of a speech where he said, we are the Constitution. It's our attitude.
Right.
That make the Constitution what it is. It is in itself just a piece of parchment.
Right.
But the right hammered
took
him
it
for
out
that.
Of context, I'm, right.
Oh, totally. Totally.
I can't
apparently
stand
the
that
Charlottesville.
Either.
Right. So that's the smear world. That's the world of smear. So they've got people working 24/7, thousands of them. thousands of people watching both sides 24/7, waiting to pull something out of context,
right,
or just make shit up, or just they're going after Tulsi Gabbard and claiming she's a Putin stooge. Hello, are you kidding me? Tulsi Gabbard is a Putin stooge. Meanwhile, Biden's groping 12-year-olds, and they don't mention that. Holy crap, what kind of media do we have? So yeah, the media's let us down in a very big way, but they're just paid to lie.
The Biden thing's interesting. I texted my mother about that when that whole thing was coming to light. My mother can't stand Trump, and she's also leans left, but she's also very deeply rooted in common sense. So I wanted to test the waters a little bit, and I sent her a message the one day. What do you make of this whole, Biden thing? And she just texts me back. He's a pervert,
Yeah, but the Biden story, the media kept it 100% restricted to adults.
Right.
And that's not the story. Biden can slobber all over the wives of his colleagues. I don't care. He's a disgusting pig, but I don't care. But he's groping kids, and the media's not touching it.
Right.
So here's my theory on Biden. I don't think Biden's a real candidate. I think he's out there to keep everyone busy while they sort of position their potential candidates. I think he's a stalking horse. And the real candidate's going to sort of hide behind. This is the sort of the Ben Hunt model, And so Biden's keeping the right-wing attack machine busy.
Right.
While they get Kamala Who's Harris or Pete or whatever the hell his name is, butt plug Pete, whatever his name is. I don't think that's it, but it's close. It actually is close. And I think they released the adult molestation story themselves to see if they
really
could get it out early, to see if they could fight it back, to get the pro-Biden team writing articles and then say, oh, that's just old news. We already know that. That's not interesting anymore.
Hmm.
And that's why if it had come from the right and it was a serious attack, it would have been videos of kids getting grabbed. They're out there. If you guys, the listeners, don't believe me, go look up Creepy Joe or something on YouTube, or Groping Joe on YouTube, and you'll see compilations of Biden grabbing kids and whispering creepy shit in their ears and stuff. And it's just disgusting, and it's clear that he's just a perv.
How do you know it's creepy shit?
Because you can hear him. The mic's on.
Oh.
You can hear him, and he's going, when you get older, don't do this. He's talking about dating and stuff, and you're going, Jesus Christ, what are you doing? And anyone who watches it goes, oh, my God, but he's also grabbing their breasts, for Christ's sake. And somehow the media is not picking up on it, although Kellyanne Conway tried to get him to bite when she said, just go search Groping Joe or Creepy Uncle Joe on YouTube. And there's so many. There's so many. You go, that's not just Joe slipping once. That's,
right.
And he uses the
right
same line on all the little kids and stuff. And you go, the guy's just a perv. When I was a kid, I was probably 10. Some eye doctor molested this shit. I didn't get damaged, but I didn't give a fuck. But he molested me. He molested my brother. And, he's pushing his thumb against my balls. And I'm going to survive this ordeal. And so we tell my mom, we said, we're not going back. And she says, oh, you got to go back, blah, blah, blah. And my dad comes over and says, what are you all fighting about? And we said, he's a perv. My dad says to my mom, they're not going back. Right? And so the kids will survive, but he's still a creepy bastard.
Right. Right.
And I don't think, you don't bring out your number one candidate this early. And I think he's just, I think it's all just a fake. I think it's all just to keep it's eye candy for until the real game starts.
Well, I think that when the wheels start turning for the next election, that we should do a weekly check-in in terms of rating the candidates on both sides of the aisle. I would love to talk to you.
You probably would
that.
Have to shoot me to get me to do that. That would be horrifying.
Well, we love having you here also, Dave. Thank you so much.
I don't think you want the nomination. If I'm Beto, right? Beto the bonehead, right? If I'm Beto or I'm Kamala, I don't want to go against Trump.
Oh, no. I don't know.
Right? That would be awful. What you want to do is you want to put on a great showing and have some other sucker get pounded by Trump.
Trump has a knack for just steamrolling people. I don't know.
And then, and then 2024 be the odds on favorite candidate.
Right, right, yeah.
Right, so you want to
play the long game, right.
You want to spar, right, and these candidates are all young. It's not like Kamala's going to get too old.
Right.
Biden's crazy old, right? And did you see the video of him? It was a speech. They took out snippets. But it was like 5 minutes of snippets, and he's incoherent.
No.
And he's babbling, and you're going, holy shit, he sounds like he's having a stroke.
It's
unbelievable number of times he just totally garbled. And maybe he's just exhausted. You know, Obama once referred to 53 states. We know he knows there's 50. He
right.
had to have been exhausted beyond comprehension.
Sure,
too
sure.
soon for Biden to be keeling over, though. It's
sure.
way too soon, right? Hillary wasn't even coughing at this point, right?
That's one thing I will say about Trump. Is, you know, he is a monster
durable.
When it comes to fucking, he's up at 5 a.m. and he's doing rallies until midnight, and then he's up again the next day, and he's going, and he's doing 2, 3, 4 rallies in a day, and when he stands up there and he's saying, Hillary Clinton doesn't have the stamina, okay,
Dave? You're way too good
she
at
does,
that. That's
she
creepy.
Doesn't have the stamina. I'm thinking to myself, man, I don't know where this guy gets it from. He doesn't appear to do anything physical besides cheat at golf and, you know, eat Kentucky Fried Chicken on his airplane. He, you know, isn't exactly a beacon of physical fitness, but the fucking guy is a monster. He's
So I might have mentioned this.
He works 17 hours a day.
I know. I might have mentioned this, but I got to have dinner with Jonah Goldberg, and I said to him I thought Trump was dyslexic. You actually look at it, I'm thinking, yeah, he's dyslexic. That's why he doesn't read. That's why he messes things
right.
up. Right. I thought that made sense. He said, no. He says he's sleep deprived. Goldberg says he's sleep deprived. He's just constantly sleep deprived.
Interesting.
And I can't refute that because apparently he just works all day. So,
and it was one thing I had to take notice of it during the campaign because I'm thinking to myself, like, you know, I feel like I know what the engine inside of a person is like when they're working that much or, you know, just on the campaign. If you can survive a presidential campaign, your stamina, and I'll say the same thing for Hillary Clinton, is, you know, you're in the 99th percentile, right?
I mean, it's unbelievable. But that's why her health let go, I think. I mean, I think
right.
she has some other issues. But and then, of course, they tried to hide him. Everyone's going, that's just fake news. I go, really? The fact that she almost fell over?
Oh, she collapsed.
She collapsed in front of the van. No. There's no question. She's continued to show that. She apparently has had episodes recently. So she clearly has serious health problems of some kind. But you're right. Trump's just a Goliath. He's just a... And whether you like him or not, that part is real.
Right.
So I wouldn't want to go against him. So if I were a presidential candidate on the left, I would want to come in second place.
Yeah, and there's no – he's not, you know, tactfully disassembling his opponents. He's picking them up like fucking Bam Bam in the Flintstones and just wham, 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 just
or
slamming
like
them against it.
Right?
I mean,
he's
yeah,
jumping
like
off the ropes.
Oh yeah, all the things you thought he was never gonna say during the debates, and oh my god, he's got fucking Juanita Broderick sitting in the front row, and you know
that was unbelievable.
Trump, you say
he
grab him by
the
pussy.
Victims. Oh my god!
And then he goes on Bill Clinton. I know we talked about this already, but I mean, he bludgeoned his way to the presidency, and
no question,
you know it's. It's a tactic, and he's good at it. So, anyways.
Well, unfortunately, it may have created a new tactic to be used by others. I would like to think this is a one-off. This has been brutal.
Yeah. So, anyways, Dave Colm, listen, my good friend. What's going on, 6:15? We're going to call it an evening tonight, but I do want to have
you
back on. Maybe a month or so, we'll check back in soon, and want everybody to follow you on Twitter. You're at David B. Colm, right?
Right.
And I'll link to you when I put the tweet up. But listen, man, thank you so much for coming on again.
It's always fun.
It's always awesome fun. Talking to you. I really appreciate it.
Adios.
All right, Dave. Talk to you soon.
Bye.
That was the one, the only Dave Colm. There you go. You can hear him hanging up the phone, and you hear the little beep, so you know how low fly this whole situation is here. Basically, I just got the thing plugged into my fucking phone, and that's it. It's not a very high-tech operation, folks. Anyways, that was Dave Colum. I have another guest planned for Thursday of this week. Thank you so much for listening. I'm sorry I haven't been around too much this month, but I appreciate the shit out of you guys, and I appreciate the shit especially out of all my patrons that continue to support the podcast. I am out of here for now. Peace!